Come to Morricone Island. It's Devin 11 show for your film and TV soundtracks. It's the number one place to go. From old world to new. Like a cool breeze coming through. Yes, it's Morricone Island.
You're listening to Morricone Island on WFMU. I'm your host, Devin Levins. I have special guests joining me, New York-based director Daniel Weintraub. He'll be discussing his recent documentary, Deep Listening, the story of Pauline Oliveros. It's a new film project on the life and work of the composer, performer, educator, and humanitarian, amongst other things. And it's told through interviews with the subject herself, peers, people you know, like Terry Riley, Morton Subotnick, disciples, Thurston Moore, a treasure trove of rare photographs, home movies, hand-drawn scores, signal flow diagrams, unheard recordings, and live performance footage. So you must see this. It's for the huge Pauline fan. There's going to be a lot of stuff you've never seen before. And for the uninitiated, you're going to have your mind blown, I think. We just booked the film for a screening downstairs in Monty Hall, the performance space here at WFMU, for July 14th. With any luck, Daniel will be there to present and maybe even do a Q&A or something like that. But regardless, get there if you can. And first and foremost, want to welcome Daniel Weintraub to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start from the beginning? Like how did you first discover Pauline Oliveros' music, and how did this whole film project, which I know had been in the works for a long time, come about?
Well, I had been, my intro to Pauline was really through my sort of obsession with early electronic music. So I'm one of those people who knew her as an electronic musician, which of course I later found out is really not true at all. She just happens to be one of the first people who ever did electronic music, but it was really only a very brief period of her career. But I was really interested in how people were making electronic music before there were, you know, all the tools that we have today. So I was really into people like her and, you know, Raymond Scott and, you know, these early electronic music pioneers. About 10 years ago, I moved from New York City to the Hudson Valley. You know, while in New York for about 20 years, I made, you know, a lot of films, but they were all short films, mostly narrative. You know, I edited a couple feature-length documentaries, but I hadn't made my own feature yet. So I figured when I got to the Hudson Valley, I'd finally have the bandwidth to jump into making myself a documentary feature, but I had no idea what the subject was. And sort of like most things with this project, it just kind of appeared in front of me. So I think it was probably the second day I was up here, my neighbor came over. I didn't even mention to her that I was going to make a film. And I told her I'm a musician and a filmmaker. And she says, oh, you should make a film about Pauline Oliveros. I immediately went home and Googled, like, see if there was a film about Pauline. And kind of astounding to me. You know, the idea really just clicked for some reason. And I started to dig more deeply into Pauline. You know, I found what a lot of people have mentioned to me as this film is screened around the world over the last year and a half, how Pauline had a gift, you know, particularly with her sort of her writings and philosophy of sound and deep listening. You know, she had a real gift for describing what most people would consider to be very abstract ideas and just the most simple, straightforward language. So as I was reading, you know, reading some of her writings, I just started to feel like she was explaining stuff that had been in my head, you know, since I was a teenager. And so my interest really started to grow. I through my neighbor who knew Pauline, of course, and she had done some grant writing for Pauline over the years. It's a very small community up here. So I didn't know, but Pauline was living 20 minutes away from me on top of all of that. You know, I introduced myself via email and sent a couple sort of samples of my work. And about a year later, my neighbor orchestrated a lunch meeting with myself and Pauline and Ione. And you know, first thing they said to me is, you know, we've been thinking Pauline needs a movie. So, you know, serendipity sort of fell into place. I think Pauline was very attracted to the idea that, you know, when I'm not a filmmaker, I'm a musician and a recording engineer. So really the thing that she and I shared, you know, more than anything else was just our love for sound. And I think, you know, that was a really good starting place for her and for myself. And about a week later, I was filming. And then I spent 3 years pretty much following Pauline all over, anything she did in the Northeast, you know, as well as going out to California and doing interviews. And 10 years later, I had a movie.
I remember Roulette was doing like fundraisers for you, and it's been going on for a while. Also, you actually got to record her somewhat too in your studio.
I did actually. I recorded one record and mixed another one. There's one record, Thalam McNonis and Nels Klein. Most people know Nels from Wilco, but he's actually, you know, one of the greatest living improvising guitar players as well. And his buddy Thalam McNonis, who's just an unbelievable keyboard wizard. They have a trio where they bring in a third person and they do free improvisation. I think William Parker was the one before Pauline. So yeah, I was lucky enough to record that. It's called Molecular Affinity, and it's on, I believe it's on Roratorio Records. That was an amazing, amazing experience. Yeah.
Is that the footage you see in the film?
That's footage from the session. Yeah. So I just sort of set up a camera and went back in the other room and manned the dials. And it's so much fun to record something like that, because those guys, I mean, they don't talk about anything. There's no, you wouldn't even know they're about to do a session if you're hanging out with them 10 minutes before. So all I had to do was set up the mics, make sure it was sounding good. And then I just sat back while they like played for 3 hours. And then they're like, I think that's good. And then, you know, and then I mixed it and Thalam sort of cut it up into tracks. And that was the record. And then I also mixed another record, which actually was really amazing. You see it in the film as well, with Mia Masaoka. And I didn't record that, but I ended up mixing that. And that was my favorite session that I saw, just because there was another woman, unfortunately, whose name is escaping me now, who played a one string koto, like a real Japanese master. And just the combo between those three is just incredible combination of sounds and abilities. And I think Important Records is going to finally be putting that out. So I'd keep an eye out for that, because I think it's one of the best things I heard from Pauline.
Right. For the uninitiated at WFMU listener and beyond, can you just briefly describe her, Pauline Olivares's background, who she is? And certain people may know her, like know the Deep Listening record. Some may know the early tape experimental records, and some people may not know any of that, and sort of what she was doing in her last 10, 15 plus years around New York and beyond. But who was Pauline?
I think most people know Pauline either as an electronic musician, or they know her through her deep listening practice, which is a practice that she developed throughout her entire career to essentially first to teach herself and then to teach other people, you know, how to really, really listen with the whole body. You know, her entire work sort of led up to that, which was her also most important to her legacy. But she really, you know, she's very hard to define, which is, I think, why it took me 10 years to figure out how to tell her story, because she is so many things. I mean, she's obviously a writer and a philosopher about sound. I mean, she has published especially her books of essays. I would highly recommend them, Software for People and Sounding the Margins. And there are collections of her essays all about sound and her experiences as a player and a composer. So she started as a composer and a pretty much straightforward new music classical composer. Most people don't realize that, but she was, you know, her original scores were notated, played by orchestras or, you know, or small ensembles. And, you know, she was winning awards for that stuff, you know, when she was like 29, 30 years old, which is really nuts, because we're talking here about late 50s, early 60s. I mean, there just were no women. Women were not expected to be doing that. And she was also out, you know, a gay woman, and made no secret of that. And she really just accomplished these, you know, fantastic things. And then as soon as she accomplished that, she left it all behind to do electronic music. And she and her compatriots were all classical musicians who were drawn to electronic music by the idea that they just wanted to make sounds that were kind of outside the canon, you know, outside the sounds that they were familiar with from their instruments and other instruments, and to hear new sounds. And so that's what drove them to electronic music. And then Pauline went on to academia briefly, where she was one of the founders of basically the experimental music program. Is the first ever experimental music program and electronic music program in the country at UCSD. And Pauline was brought in to help run that program. And while she was there, she, of course, departed from electronic music and She then began the work that I think she's probably most well known for amongst people who know, which is she began doing what's called text scores. So essentially, she abandoned traditional notation in favor for written instructions, in favor of written instructions that would allow non-musicians to understand and perform the scores. And that was an extremely controversial thing for her to be doing. No conductors, you know, no expertise, no elitism. And that was, you know, that was kind of what pushed off, you know, for the rest of her career and led to a deep listening practice. And, you know, while she composes music still for virtuoso musicians, and understand that she describes a virtuoso as someone who has complete access to both their technical ability and their imagination at the same time. It's not enough just to be able to play like a wizard.
Yeah.
You know, you can tell by the length of this answer how crazy it goes on and on. But, you know, she's an incredible technological innovator. She, you know, was very, very intrigued by technology from the time she started with electronic music and developed some amazing pieces of software that are used pretty widely now. Yeah, I probably just confused your listeners even more, but hopefully rather than confuse them, I intrigue them, because the cool thing about Pauline is that, you know, there's something in there for everybody. Even with her music, you know, I mean, some of that music is very, very accessible and some of it is really, really difficult. So you kind of have to find your place with Pauline. But, you know, the most important thing for us in making this film was that, you know, the lessons that she has for contemporary culture are just immense. This, you know, this idea of listening and community, you know, something that we really need in the world right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I had the fortunate experience last weekend to catch the film in, you know, a big theater. Happened to be in San Diego at my alma mater, and where she was a, as you said, the co-founder, I think, of the music department in general at UC San Diego. And it was announced, you know, it was presented by Mark Dresser, who is also alumni there and a professor. He's back in San Diego teaching there. Amongst many people have come out of that department. I mean, Diamanda Glass. When I started, I think it was about 6 years after she had left, but her name loomed large there. You know, also her mentor, right, who brought her there was
Robert Erickson
at the tape from the Tape Center, and or her earliest proponent when she was just studying with him, right, in San Francisco. It sounds like she had made a beeline from Houston, Texas, to San Francisco.
Yeah, she left, you know, around 20 years old, realized that Houston wasn't going to be the place for her. And heard good things about San Francisco, and obviously it was a good choice for her. And, you know, a lot of that had to do with her sexuality, but also with, you know, the racism that she saw in Houston, which is not really one of the things I kind of regret not putting in the film. But, you know, there was a lot. She was a very open-minded, forward-thinking person. I mean, not only as a human, but as an artist, she was typically, you know, 10 to 20 years in front of everybody else. And socially, that was the case too, just in her comfort and knowing who she was. And so, yeah, and Robert Erickson, I think, is, you know, you have to, so Robert Erickson was her teacher, her first composition teacher that she really, really was inspired by. And he also happened to be the composition teacher of Terry Riley and Lauren Rush. It's kind of nuts because people don't realize, for those who are into, you know, contemporary classical music, basically everybody that you know, except for Philip Glass, was there. They were all there. Gordon Mumma, Steve Reich. I mean, they were all there before anybody knew who they were, you know, sharing these ideas. And so much of that came from Erickson. I think the inspiration for them to start doing free improvisation came from Erickson. And then, of course, when he was hired to start the new music department at UCSD, he invited Pauline to join him. So that's how she started in academia.
Yeah. For music students there, it's like those two names, you know, they're synonymous with Beethoven or something. They don't seem like real people in the sense, you know, because it's like their name is everywhere and the professors are always referencing them. And
yeah.
It was pretty cool to see all of the footage that you had from the San Diego days too, you know, because you actually got to see them performing or whatever, just doing typical things that people do in their lives or whatever. But it was like that period from the really like the late 60s till early 80s before she moved to New York, right? And then just an incredible story and footage too is, you know, the infamous first Deep Listening record, which occurred in a 14-foot deep cistern in Washington, right? The state of Washington. You actually have footage of, right, that is incorporated there. And that's maybe her most well-known recording. And I think you and I were discussing before, you know, sort of a launching off point for the uninitiated, like a good record to start with. Did you actually go to the cistern?
No, I didn't. I did not. That would have been amazing. I don't think in talking to Stuart Dempster, who is, you know, basically Pauline's sort of oldest friend and longest collaborator and the other founding member of the Deep Listening Band, which actually came out of that recording that you're discussing, which they named as a pun. A lot of people are fun. It's funny because a lot of people think, like, with something called Deep Listening, that Pauline is some like new age guru or something. Yeah. But actually, Deep Listening is just a joke she was making because they were recording 14 feet underground. And you know, that was hugely important for her because I think, you know, she's very interested in, for one thing, this idea of when you're playing, for those of you who don't know, this is a water cistern outside Seattle that has, I believe, a 45-second long reverb. So, you know, when that's happening, you have this interesting phenomenon where you have to play with yourself. You know, so every time you play something, that note is going for 45 seconds. It heightens this idea of listening, which was hugely important to Pauline, but also this idea of playing with time, which is something that she was really obsessed with her whole life. You know, this idea that the sound that's coming back to you, you know, in the present is from 45, you know, seconds in the past was really intriguing to her. And she also developed tape systems and ultimately computer software that kind of mimicked this concept too of a sound coming back to you that you made in a slightly different way than the way you made it. You know, they would even call this computer system sometimes like a member of the band. It's really, it was something that she was really fascinated with. So that, in addition to coining the phrase deep listening, I think that recording really illuminated for her a lot of things that she, you know, obsessed with for her final couple decades.
Yeah, I always knew, you know, there was electronics involved with that recording, but it was, you know, primarily her on accordion and trombone and didgeridoo and some vocals and stuff like that.
There's no electronics.
Is there no
at all?
Absolutely zero?
None.
Oh, I thought it's one was maybe a keyboard of some sort, but
nope. It's a guy with a tape recorder.
Tape recorder. Okay.
That's it. That's
and
the
it's
only
a 45 second delay.
Yeah, it's no manipulation before, after, during at all. It's only the sound that was recorded. So
that's just nuts. And that was eye opening
really
from your film where you got to see that and realize that there's no there's nothing in the way, you know, as far as electronics and things like that.
Yeah, and they didn't even know what they were getting into, you know. I mean, Stuart, I think, had only heard about it, you know, so they basically showed up there with their instruments, and as Pauline says in the movie, they just sat down and started to play.
Yeah.
And they just happened to think, like, this could be interesting, let's bring a guy to record it, and that's the record. I mean, that's it. Yeah, it's very, very, very simple.
And so I guess what a lot of people don't realize is accordion ended up, although she played piano and what was it, tuba, a bunch of different...
French horn was her big one.
French horn, yeah. But she ended up landing on accordion. And like even in the Deep Listening recordings, that's accordion. And that again, that's just, you get reminded. I mean, I think throughout the years, you know this, and you think of her, oh yeah, she's doing a improv thing at Tonic, you know, with a couple of her performers and she's on the accordion, but you forget because you keep going back to that electronic musician, electronic music pioneer. But she really embraced it. And you even had footage of her klezmer band, which predates that whole knitting factory radical
before the klezmer revival,
Jewish,
yeah,
new wave, yeah, or whatever they call,
yeah,
it
the klezmatics, etc. Yeah, no, that's definitely before that.
And it's wild. It's,
I mean, as early as
it would have just fit right in perfectly, or the other way around, you know.
Yeah, that was an incredible band. And you know, Ron Raboy, who was actually a you know, one of the primary cellists in the San Diego Symphony, you know, had this obsession with early klezmer, and he, you know, Pauline basically facilitated that for him, and he transcribed these pieces off of records and found some old music. I mean, it's really like a historical project performed by a bunch of unbelievable musicians. And that was such a gift to actually have footage of that. I think it was shot on 3/4-inch video.
Yeah.
You know, 81, I believe, is the date of that footage. And just, it looks amazing and it sounds amazing. And that's, I got really lucky, particularly in San Diego, with finding little nuggets of gold like that, because it's very hard to, you know, people don't realize in these days that between 1950 and 1990, or, you know, 85, people did not just obsessively document their lives, especially in, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s. You know, there's a period where I didn't know how I was worried I wouldn't be able to tell the story of San Francisco at all, because they just didn't take pictures. It's kind of crazy.
Let alone, you know, video.
Yeah, video or film. It would be film back then. But I mean, there, even I interviewed people who were literally photographers who didn't take pictures, you know, like they'd have this one guy, Ronald Chase, who when Pauline left, and I think it was 68, 69, when she left San Francisco and headed to maybe 67, headed to UCSD. They had a huge party, like a 24-hour party called the Tapeathon, where they played every single electronic piece that Pauline had ever made. And they had, like, you know, performers and like softcore pornography, like on the wall. And it was in Ronald Chase's photography studio. And I asked him, did you take any pictures? And he says, no. I'm like, why? He's like, I didn't think about it. You know, like they didn't realize that they were making history. And I think possibly that's the reason they did make history. It's because they would just had this total freedom to just do whatever they want. They weren't really worried about posterity or anything like that. So, you know, it's sort of a lesson for us in these days that sometimes you need to live in the moment. Don't worry about what people are going to think later, especially if you want to achieve something original.
So where did you find a lot of that old San Francisco footage and
or... Well, the footage, the film that's in San Francisco, that's all just stock footage. I mean, there's so much out there, but most of that is from this great little company called Oddball Films, which has this huge library of stock footage that's made up mostly of just obscure, like, home movies that they probably found in some garage sale or something. So a lot of that footage of San Francisco in the 50s and 60s is literally like somebody's vacation from the 50s. The rest, the actual photographs of the people and the San Francisco Tate Music Center, of which there's only a handful, Bill McGinnis, who was the tech at the San Francisco Tate Music Center, really important person, as you can imagine, because they were, you know, people don't realize there was no electronic music equipment. It didn't exist. There were no studios in America. So what they had living in San Francisco was this enormous stockpile of discarded war gear. So they basically, all this stuff was like military equipment that they repurposed to make music with. So they had to have a really good tech. And on top of that, you know, something that's not covered in the film that's usually important is the fact that they created the Buchla there, you know, the Buchla synthesizer, which was basically concurrently with the Moog, like the first ever synthesizer, definitely the first, you know, what we call a modular synthesizer. So they needed a really good tech, and Bill McGinnis was the man. And so almost all those photos are literally in like a shoebox that he had in his house. Like, that's where it's at. The music is much better. So Mills College, a woman at Mills College, RIP, not the woman, but Mills, Maggie Payne, took all the tapes from the San Francisco Tape Music Center and digitized them. So there is an amazing stockpile of the sound. Like, when I'm talking in the film about like a concert at San Francisco Tape Music Center, you're hearing audio of literally that original performance, including the audience reaction and stuff like that. So that's a real gift in terms of sound. And that's why there's so much sound in the film that hasn't been heard before. But images, man, that was rough, really rough. And there's just not much at all in San Francisco. San Diego got a little bit better, primarily because Lynn Lonidier, who was Pauline's partner for a while, just took a ton of Super 8 film.
Where were those housed? At the school, or?
Oh, no. This is all, you know, the school. UCSD has an incredible archives, definitely the biggest. And I got a lot from there. But I got a lot of stuff just, it's kind of the way this, it has a little bit to do with how Pauline works. And I think she kind of knew this would happen. Obviously, you know, I was working with Pauline on this film, but she never told me what kind of film she wanted, or literally all she did was start out the process. She gave me a list of probably like 7 or 8 people that she thought I should really talk to, including some that she knew she would have to introduce me to, or they wouldn't talk to me, because a lot of those folks like Anna Halperin and, you know, these people who I interviewed while they're in the 80s, 90s, I mean, they weren't doing interviews anymore. You know, they did it because they loved Pauline and got really lucky to meet them and sit down and learn from them and hear their stories. So she gave me about 7 or 8 people to talk to and a couple archives to look at. And that's about it. You know, I ended up going to about 6 different archives and interviewing 30 people, over 30 people, because everyone that she told me to talk to gave me 4 more. And sometimes it was just like, you know, I remember that Pauline's, you know, partner always had this Super 8 camera. You know, I think her brother is still around. And then I got connected with her brother. And it just so happens that he was, you know, after years after, you know, she passed away younger. He was finally clearing out her studio. And, you know, I've been meaning to do something with those films. So he actually transferred all of it for me because he wanted it anyway. And I went and met with him, and there it was. I had a hard drive full of these just incredible, you know, not only, you know, she was an artist, so these were creatively edited, and a lot of the stuff that's in there is the way she edited it. And it includes, you know, a huge section of Pauline's career in San Diego and the people that she was working with there. So that was a tremendous gift. And then the other one is Becky Cohen, who's a fantastic photographer who was a friend and colleague of Pauline's in San Diego. She ended up having these amazing, beautiful photographs, the famous photo of Pauline on the elephant, for example. And also this, I should say, Lynn Lonidier, her brother is an amazing photographer, the guy who got me the film. He also took a lot of pictures. So a lot of the photo, there's some really iconic photos from the film that are now being actually used with Pauline everywhere. It shows her doing deep listening at Joshua Tree, which is where they would go and they would have retreats, and these beautiful photographs of that. So I got really lucky just with community. I mean, honestly, like just people willing to help me out, you know, and it's continued after I finished the film.
Oh, you mentioned the Buchla, which has been
referenced
on the last, this is the third week in a row now someone's referenced the Buchla.
That's funny.
Of course. Which are very expensive pieces of electronics these days. Did she own a Buchla?
No, Pauline really was not, you know, there's actually a funny, you know, she was not really into the Buchla until she had to be. She wasn't interested. Like she had her thing she was doing with oscillators and tape machines, and that was good. You know, the Buchla was really Mort Subotnick's baby. It was his idea. He as he described it to me, he wanted a paint box for sound. And there's a funny, actually, at the exact moment that Pauline had her little studio in the attic of the San Francisco Tape Music Center, and at the exact moment that Buchla was downstairs revealing for the very first time the Buchla synthesizer, Pauline was up in the attic creating Bye Bye Butterfly, which is her most famous electronic music piece. So yeah, she was pretty, it wasn't until she got to Mills when, you know, the Tape Music Center, you know, it sort of outgrew itself. It got very successful. They had a concert called the Tudor Fest that where John Cage came, and it was super high profile. And so they got a huge grant, and that grant required them to move into a facility. So they moved to Mills College, and Pauline went along as the director of music there. So she had to learn the Buchla, because they have, it's in the film, actually, they at Mills College, they have the original Buchla. It even says San Francisco Tape Music Center on it. It's super cool. So she had to learn it because she had to teach her students. And then she did end up liking it. And she actually created a lot of pieces on the Buchla by the end. But and she taught it again down at UCSD. But it was never super inspiring for her. I mean, she did, like I said, she did fall in love with it really briefly and make some great pieces. But that was really, you know, it was Mort Subotnick had this idea, and Bill McGinnis actually met Buchla, I think, at a concert. Buchla came up and they started talking, and Bill was like, wow, this guy seems to know what he's talking about. And then he started asking him, like, could you build this? They wanted a what's called a ring modulator, basically a special effect that could run sounds through and create funky sounds. And he's like, yeah, sure, I think I can do that. And he came back like 2 days later with this thing. And they're like, wow, this guy's kind of special. So they started to talk to him about this idea that Mort had. And that's what led to, you know, the creation of the Buchla synthesizer, which is now, you know, essentially the you know, the framework for, you know, a whole family of synthesis out there. Eurorack, and if anybody knows anything about modular synthesis, it all comes from the Buchla. Pretty amazing. I love them. I actually have, I mean, I don't have a Buchla myself, but I do play around with modular synthesis, and it's a blast. It's kind of like for that, you know, they didn't like this idea of the Moog. They didn't want, you know, like, as I mentioned, these are classical musicians who wanted to create new sounds. They didn't want it to look like an instrument. So they didn't want anything with a keyboard that just makes different sounds. And so the Buchla has no keyboard. It's just patch cables, and you feed a sound into it, and then you manipulate that sound using the various filters and stuff. And it's incredibly hard to predict what you're going to get, which is, I think, the beauty of it. You know, you it's all about finding an amazing accident and hearing a sound you've never heard before. It's like the perfect tool for that.
Also, you referenced this 1957 live improvisational for a film recording, but I was hoping you could explain that. And also, I always look, because this is a film soundtrack show first and foremost, I always look to see if the subject or the composer or whatever has done film. I did see, like, on IMDb that she has 11 credits, you know, some shorts, some look like a documentary, some look like feature length films, independent films. Did she do some actual film scoring?
She did, I think, for a film for short. Now, normally it would be in association with the dancer she worked with. So, you know, she started her career, huge inspiration for her was Anna Halperin, who was actually about 10 years older than Pauline and had kind of done what Pauline wanted to do. She was a woman in San Francisco who had made a career for herself, essentially breaking down boundaries in her art form. And so Pauline was really, you know, interested in working with dancers early on and continued that. She worked with another one named Elizabeth Harris in San Francisco, and then later with Deborah Hay. And, you know, so she's done a lot of music for dance, and some of those dances ended up becoming films, and she did the soundtrack for that. So she has some short film soundtrack work. The one that you're speaking of in 1957, so, you know, Terry Riley and Pauline were really early on, were friends. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to tell you a great story in the film. So, you know, they were studying. It wasn't with Robert Erickson, who we discussed earlier, but it was another composition class at San Francisco State that Pauline was taking. She was the only woman. And when it came to the days to review the scores, she would always go last, and everyone in the class would leave before her music was performed. And I think this was partly because, A, she was a woman, but also she was already creating, you know, music that was not easily categorized and was a little bit, you know, challenging, especially for those conventional composers who were in that class. But what happened is some guys started to hang out and watch her pieces, and that was Terry Riley and Lauren Rush, and they became really, really strong friends. And once they started to study with Erickson, he started to tell them to try free improvisation as a compositional tool. And Terry Riley had a commission, that's the word I'm looking for, to do a soundtrack for a movie about a sculptor named Claire Falkenstein. And he never got around to composing anything. So he brought up the idea, why don't we go into the studio and let's improvise a soundtrack. So they did that. They went in there for like three sessions. So Lauren Rush worked at the radio station where they had a nice tape machine and a nice microphone. And it's interesting, Pauline, on those recordings, she's actually playing French horn, which is really cool because almost every other free improvisation she ever did in her life was on the accordion. But it's Terry Riley on piano, Pauline on French horn, and Lauren Rush, I believe, on bass and percussion. And this is, you know, from my research and talking to scholars, like, nobody knows an earlier example of classical musicians being recorded doing free improvisation. When I spoke to Lauren Rush, I learned that, in fact, you know, 200 years ago, free improvisation was actually part of the classical training regimen. But nowadays, no, I mean, you hear stories all the time about, you know, extremely virtuosic classical musicians who can't improvise at all.
Yeah. That's
so,
the stereotype.
So, yeah, that's it. And it's kind of, you know, like a lot of stereotypes, there's some truth in there. You know, it's breaking down now. Of course, you have one of the things that took Pauline away from electronic music was the fact that there started to be musicians who were willing to approach their instruments in a more creative fashion and come up with new sounds. And, you know, now that's everywhere. And so that's a beautiful thing. So those you know, that's changed a lot. But those recordings are amazing. The sound quality is beautiful. Hopefully you'll play one. And the incredible thing is, for those who follow free improvisation or fans of it, it's all there in those recordings. It's sort of like a language, like a template. It's really incredible. So that was an amazing find to have that. You know, that's in the other music archive. Other Music is an archive that comes out of KQED, which was obviously a huge part of what was going on in San Francisco back then, because they had really, really cutting edge programming. They actually broadcast some of the concerts from the San Francisco Tape Music Center, and they had a really big reach. So a lot of people were getting exposed for the very first times in their lives to a new approach to music, honestly.
And it sounds like during the course of the onset of you starting off on this production and concluding it, you know, getting it to this point, you know, a few years in, and we unfortunately lost Pauline, like 2016, right? So I assume that
that's correct.
The mission statement or the production in general was kind of altered. In that sense, yeah. I'm assuming, did it take on sort of a new meaning in life, I assume, at that point?
It's a little hard to say because, you know, I hadn't really started editing at that time. And I didn't, for anyone who's a documentary filmmaker, editing is pretty much the writing process. You know,
yeah.
If you're scripting that thing before the editing, then it's not probably what I would consider a real documentary. Unless you're talking about voiceover, which I was not going to use in this film. You know, I wanted Pauline to tell the story. So, you know, from a really practical standpoint, I had actually finished most of the production at that time. And the only thing I hadn't done was I had been saving, you know, I did 2 long interviews with Pauline and I planned to do 4. So I essentially never interviewed Pauline at all about anything after San Francisco, a little bit about San Diego and a little bit about telematics and some other things. But so that was an interesting dilemma for me, and ended up, I think, actually making the film better, because I had to really dig deep and find these interviews of Pauline throughout time. So you hear her voice, you hear her like gradually losing the Texas accent, and you know, it helps to, because a huge part of Pauline is the, you know, it's really important to note that she, you know, that she was going strong from the mid 50s. And always at the very forefront of, you know, music and culture. And I think by using these interviews through time, it helped to augment that. And, you know, it also goes along with this, you know, the footage that I have, which is every format basically existed, including a bunch of video formats that, you know, only lasted for like a year, like Hi8 video, stuff like that. You know, of course, there's a lot of DV in there, and then 3/4 inch video and 16 millimeter film and 8 millimeter film. So the audio, so that actually ended up being kind of a gift in a way, and creatively. You know, one thing that happened to me personally was, you know, when you see the film, you see Pauline is just an extremely personable, low key individual. You know, I mean, her charisma and her collaboration ability and leadership ability, you know, were that of a giant, but she didn't really come across that way at all. So most of the time I was spending with Pauline, it was really like, I'm going to Pauline's house. You know, we're hanging out. buying some soup from the takeout. And, you know, so when she passed away, it really made me realize that she had changed my life. So, you know, I had to come to terms with that. I had to come to terms then with the fact that perhaps I was feeling a bit more pressure in terms of a legacy film, I guess you would say. So I really set aside any of my own wishes and intentions at that point, which I hadn't been doing before. You know, the film I ended up making was not what I had hoped to make. I hoped to make a film that was more experimental, that would be more of my own self-expression, but also more of in line with Pauline's aesthetic. And, you know, I began to realize that I couldn't really do that and tell this story with so much information. And you can't, for example, you know, I realized you can't be nonlinear either. You can't really talk about deep listening before you talk about electronic music. You have to see how she arrived at deep listening. So I ended up making this pretty straightforward, you know, biological film. And you know, the other thing that we realized was really important, some of this was subconsciously, but as we got towards the end of the film, it became very conscious, was that, you know, we don't mention her passing in the film. It's not there at all. And that's because, you know, what I realized that there's a great, really great quote in the film, most people's favorite quote, where she says something like, "I never tried to build a career. I only tried to build a community." And what I've discovered is, you know, the amazing thing is when that's how you shape your career, when you're gone, your career doesn't stop. So Pauline created this body of work that's now like carried on by this community. And because of the nature of her work, these tech scores and stuff like that, there's room for it to expand and grow, even though she's not here. So that became a really important thing with the film, was to hopefully, like, you know, give people a big dose of Pauline that they can carry out into the world. And, you know, and that's been the case with this film is, you know, I've screened this film probably 60 times and I don't know, over 20 different countries and no distributor. In fact, we haven't even like tried to get screenings. People just once the film was done, they either tracked me down or reached out through Ione, who's Pauline's spouse, who's still very involved with the film. And yeah, we want to show this film. How can we make it happen? And that's how like 60 screenings all over the world have taken place. And, you know, I don't know anybody else who's had a film that screened that many times without a distributor or without, you know, a lot of solicitation on behalf of the film. It's incredible. And so that, and not only that, but as I traveled around the world, I saw so many of these people are making events out of it and coming up with their own little deep listening workshops or listening sessions, or, you know, when it showed in Portugal, the night, I think it was like almost midnight, they had this like listening session, this amazing loft that during the day is actually a kindergarten, which Pauline would have really loved. They set up like all these mattresses on the floor and like four speakers, and they just played Pauline's music and it was totally full.
Yeah.
And everybody just lying there on the mattress, like listening to this music. What a great idea. And they just thought of that themselves. And, you know, it's happening all over the, you know, various performances of her work, which is can be interpreted in so many different ways. You know, I just see that her influence continues to grow, even though she's not like on this plane. It's pretty amazing.
Well, the community thing goes towards what you even said. She told you seven people to contact, and then that ended up being 28, which probably led to 100, et cetera.
Yeah.
The community of that.
And, you know, beyond that, I've got subtitles in French and Spanish and Italian and all for free. You know, people like, I want to show this in French in Italy, but people here need subtitles. We'll do it. I'm like, okay. I give them just like a discounted screening. And I have, you know, it's just that kind of love is really out there. And it's, you know, it's amazing. It's really amazing. And I think it's, you know, it certainly gives me hope, because I think that Pauline's lessons about, you know, community and how we, especially how we approach technology. I mean, these things are so crucial right now. And, you know, the more people who can kind of embody that stuff, the more chance that we actually, you know, live in a civil society.
Yeah. Again, like, we're going to be screening the film at Monty Hall, the performance space on the ground floor of WFMU in downtown Jersey City, one stop in on the path from the World Trade Center. And hopefully you can make it there. What else is planned? I know last weekend you had it at UC San Diego, San Francisco, and maybe I saw Kingston, like three screenings last weekend. And I saw coming up in Europe.
I mean, this was, that's kind of an incredible story just about the magic of Pauline. It was just on Friday, which happens to be the day after Pauline's birthday, with zero effort at all for us to make this happen. We screened in Kingston, San Francisco, and San Diego on that same day, which when you see the film, you realize those are actually like the three places that the film is about. I mean, that's where Pauline lived and worked. It's really weird. It's like weird and beautiful.
You have a website set up, right?
Yeah, there's a website. So it's the story of PaulineOliveros.com. And Norm Lowry, who is a friend of Pauline's in the film, is keeping that one updated. And a year and a half, so we'll be moving on pretty soon to either streaming and or physical copies of the film. But he's really good about listing the screenings. But we've got a couple screens in the UK, another one coming up in Paris, another one in France, hopefully Brazilian premiere, and of course the New Jersey premiere. So those are all in the work. We're definitely, you know, we've been screening. We've avoided that up until now, kind of in the spirit of this community thing. I realized after seeing the film a couple times that a movie theater is a community. for people to have that shared experience. And when you see the film, there's even like an interactive element to the film that heightens that even further if people participate.
You can't really do that at home.
You can't really do that at home. So I like this idea of people seeing the film in a community with their own community where they live, and perhaps meeting other people who've been moved by Pauline, or even better, learning about Pauline for the first time. So that's why we've been really focused on the screenings, but we will be making this film more widely available, definitely by the end of this year. So check the website, thestoryofpaulineoliveros.com, and I'm sure that'll be announced there as well.
Yeah, thanks again. Good luck with the remaining screenings until streaming happens, and look forward to the screening at Monnie Hall in downtown Jersey City.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thank you so much for having me and for spreading the gospel.
And thanks for your effort in making this all happen. Someone has to do it, and you did it.
Yeah. That was kind of what you asked about, how it changed. And with me, first it was a film I wanted to make, and it then became a film I had to make.
Yeah.
That was the big, big difference. And that's why I was thinking about this. If there's any other subject, I can't imagine another subject that I would have spent 10 years on.
Right.
Like, it's just not like I like to get a film done and done, right. Like that kind of worker. But, I was thinking, is there any other subject? And I can't think of anyone. And yeah, it was a film that had to be made. And I'm glad it's out in the world.
Well, I applaud you.
Thank you so much.
Look forward to your next endeavors.
Cool.
So thanks again. And take care.